damn late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
For AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Y'all, this is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Thanks for listening. And, a couple things. Started the show off there with the flipping off FDR. Just got to talk about that at the beginning, and then I didn't even realize it. I just thought it'd be funny to play this punk rock version of that Bob Marley song there. And I just realized as I was listening to it that, you know, they talk about the end times and fulfilling the book and all that, and that's going to be a big part of today's show. In the second hour, we're going to be talking with Max Blumenthal from The Nation and The Huffington Post, who he went and videotaped at the Christians United for Israel conference, where the pre-tribulational, dispensational, pre-millennialist, evangelical, born-again Christians who are trying to force Jesus to come back on their timetable, had their big meeting. They're a big part of the base of the war party. And I guess really, once you've, you know, announced to everyone that you'll believe anything, I guess then, you know, you're low-hanging fruit, as the administration once described Iraq and Syria, you know, and useful dupes. Like the famous George Bush quote, you can't fool all the people. Nope, see, I fucked it up. That was the Lincoln quote the right way. It's, you can fool some of the people all of the time. And those are the ones you want to concentrate on. Famous quote from the President of the United States. And so, we'll be talking about them. And in fact, I think probably for the last 40 minutes or so of this hour and into the next hour, I'm going to play my interview with Bill Barnwell from LouRockwell.com, who is a Christian Methodist, some brand of, like, pretty close to Methodist, I forget exactly, preacher. I guess you could even say a fundamentalist Christian, but who does not subscribe to this ridiculous, you know, Walmart brand left behind religion that, according to him, has very little to do with the Bible. And obviously, you guys know me, I'm not much of a religious guy, but, you know, I'm not really anti. I don't really care what people believe. You know, I believe in liberty, and that, of course, you know, above all means, you know, your freedom over your own conscience. You can believe whatever you want, that's just fine. But please don't advocate that my government start a nuclear war with Iran, which, of course, can't shoot back because they don't have nukes. It would be a very one-sided nuclear war, I guess. That's where I have a problem, when people's faith gets so mixed into their politics, their, frankly, their myths that they believe in become their doctrine, their policy prescription for the powers of the American empire to be wielded for their religious purposes. And in that sense, to me, they're nothing but the American Taliban. And that's not just on foreign policy, it's on all kinds of things. You know, it's funny watching the right-wingers, the nationalist conservative types, bragging about bringing liberty to women in Afghanistan, when we all know that they're jealous of the Taliban and the way they treat women. You know, you can see it. It's pretty plain. In fact, I wish I had the soundbite, but I seem to remember, like, some Freudian slips along these lines. And, of course, I don't even need those because old Ramesh Panuru from the National Review wrote a whole book about how, yeah, see, it is our fault. No, not you know, America brought on the attack by bombing people in the Middle East and occupying their countries and propping up their dictators. Only a fool would believe that that has anything to do with the motivation for the attackers, the American government. Doing those kinds of things. No, that's not it. It's because we have such loose morals here. That's right. It is because of Las Vegas and miniskirts and liberalism. And we really ought to join up with the Talibans of the world. At least in ideals. That was a book written by the guy from National Review. Now, I didn't read it because it was too obviously a piece of crap, but I read a couple of reviews of it, and I saw his interview on the Colbert Report, and he couldn't have been clearer. It reminds me of, I think it was one of these pre-tribulational, dispensational, pre-millennialist types I heard on a talk radio show very shortly after September 11th. And he was telling the host of the show, listen, There's a lot of emotion about this. It's a big tragedy. People are still extremely worked up about these attacks. But we have to take some time out to be cautious, to be prudent and adult and rational about this. We have to ask ourselves why they did this. It's not just because they're evil and felt like doing it for evil's sake. There was a reason behind it. And If we are going to be able to protect ourselves from these terrorists in the future, we're going to have to understand what their motivations are. And the host, and I'm in the audience driving down the road going, yeah, great, wow, somebody's actually saying something that sounds grown up on the radio here. Is he going to talk about American foreign policy and occupying the Saudi desert for 10 years? And the host of the show says, oh, do tell. And he says, yeah, you have to understand, it's because Satan is behind the evil Muslim world, and Satan is trying to destroy America and the West and everything that is good and true and beautiful, and that's why we have to wage total war against all of them. Whoa! Yeah, you know, take a little kernel of something, a little, you know, just tune in for a second, sounds right for a second, then whoa, what the hell? At the end. And that's kind of, I guess, really the way it goes. I even have a bumper sticker like that. See if I can... I already said the F word right, so who cares? It says, damn, why is it that everybody who agrees with me is so full of shit? And obviously, you know, it's a joke. I understand it might be because I am. But yeah. presumably the bumper sticker consumer would also get the joke before they put it on their bumper. Okay, so yeah, we got to get to some news here. If I remember right before the show, I was thinking, wow, I'm going to have very little time to say all the things I need to say before playing these interviews and such. I need to tell you about antiwar.com. Don't you read antiwar.com every day? I do. And the reason why is because they have all the news from all the major papers in the world about every conflict in the world. Every day. Updated in real time. Every day. And if you want to know who's killing who in the world, you want your daily digest of bad news, you go to antiwar.com. A pure non-interventionist perspective. You will not see anybody crying U.S. troops out of Iraq and into Darfur on our website. No, sir. And for the first time I think I can remember ever, there's somebody smiling in the big picture on the front page of antiwar.com. What? Somebody's smiling? And not, you know, an American politician in a sarcastic kind of way. No, it's an Iraqi with his face painted in the nationalist colors of the old Iraqi flag, celebrating Iraq's victory in the Asia Cup giant football, they call it. We call it soccer tournament, where Iraq was victorious. And actually, I think I read that the level of killing had gone down just in the last few days as everybody's sitting around watching soccer and remembering that, you know, people are people and aren't we all soccer fans and that kind of thing. Of course, the team captain and the rest of them all came out immediately and said, "Don't you take credit for our victory, George Bush, you son of a bitch who tried to steal credit for our victory last time." Who came out and announced that our hard work was due to your mass murder in our country. We will thank you very much to keep your mouth shut and not take credit for our victory, please, he said. God, are you embarrassed to be an American? To have Republicans in power in this country? Going around and mass murdering and just being the caricature of everything that is a big, fat, rich, snot-nosed, spoiled, rotten, punk little bitch in the way we, as our country, our government treats everyone else in the world. I mean, if you struck it rich, would you treat all your friends like shit from now on? Take credit for all their accomplishments as you destroy them? I'm embarrassed. I get emails sometimes where people say, I can't believe that someone from Texas would be so against the government. What? Yeah, you might not know anything about the history of Texas, but we've seceded from pretty much everybody's authority except, well, our own Rick Perry's. And George Bush ain't no Texan. George Bush is from Connecticut. I see that bumper sticker that says, somewhere in Texas, a village is missing its idiot. No. It's New Haven, Connecticut that's missing its idiot. Thank you very much for insulting where I'm from. But yeah, I get that. Wow, I can't believe that someone from Texas can think because, of course, I know it's a gigantic state full of millions and millions of people and the largest university in America and so forth. But I heard George Bush was from there, so I figured you all must just love him. Yeah, I love seeing the headline, Iraqi soccer captain preemptively warning George Bush to not steal credit for his team's victory. Yeah, that's me with my, which is shielding my eyes from view, like out of embarrassment kind of thing. You can picture it, right? Off on a tangent there. I was just happy to see that some people in Iraq, you know, had a good day. Congratulations, guys. Sorry that my government murdered your family member. I wish I could do more about it, but at least I'm happy for you that you guys had your big soccer victory, for what that's worth. Oh, I'm sorry. Nobody in Iraq can hear this. They don't have any fucking electricity. I wonder how they were able to even watch the game. Maybe they just heard that they won. Maybe, like, you know, one guy had some electricity from his generator during the game and then passed out VHS tapes, and they all just passed the generators around, you know, from house to house watching the tape of the game. I don't know exactly how it happened there. I know that the vast majority of places in Iraq, they still don't even have a full day worth of electricity over there. That's what they get for the $1 trillion you've spent there so far. Or was it already more than that? Also, I got to point you in the direction of BBC Radio. And you can get there by way of my blog, thestressblog.com, or, in fact, by the way of the other Scott Horton's blog, No Comment, at harpers.com. And just in case my syntax wasn't clear, I don't mean my other blog. I mean there's another man named Scott Horton who is an international human rights lawyer, anti-torture activist. I've interviewed him, what, 3 or 4 times? Calls himself a old Burkean conservative of some kind or another, although he writes like a liberal a lot and really interesting to read. I guess, you know, old Burkean liberalism is, or old Burkean conservatism is close to classical liberalism, at least, you know, compared to the kind of ideologies that rule the day now. But anyway, he's got this great blog, and he pointed out to me, it's called No Comment at Harper's Magazine, and he pointed out to me this thing on BBC Radio, which I haven't had a chance to listen to yet because I refuse to install that piece of crap Real Player on any of my computers, but hopefully Tom from the Stress Blog is going to get me the MP3, he says. But it's about the plot to seize the White House, a story that some of you may be familiar with, some of you not. But in 1934, there was an attempted coup d'etat against the great dictator, the Tsarina, to borrow Francis E. Deck's phrase, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There's a book, a great book, called The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer. There's a couple other books where you can read about this. And basically it was and it's been a while, probably almost 10 years since I've actually read a book about this. But if I basically remember, it was the Morgans and the Rockefellers together working to create a Nazi America, to create a fascist America. Now, what is it about Franklin Roosevelt and his Herbert Hoover-style New Deal that they thought wasn't fascist enough? I don't know. That's still a mystery to me. You know, I guess it was the 30s, and everybody, you know, as Lou Rockwell wrote in his article over the weekend, in the 1930s, just like today, everybody's either a communist or a fascist. And you have to walk 15 miles to find somebody who believes in liberty or free markets. So, you know, maybe I just, I'm being too loose in my smears. And maybe Roosevelt was really more of a communist than a fascist. And that's the way the actual American fascists felt at the time. In any case, you know, best I can tell, if you ever read Wall Street and FDR by Anthony C. Sutton, I think he makes the case very well that Roosevelt was their top guy all along. And in fact, in that book, he brings up the plot to seize the White House. But I don't remember what his explanation is for why Roosevelt the Tool was almost overthrown anyway. Interesting question. Yeah, this is real. There was an attempted coup d'etat, an attempt to make America a fascist dictatorship in the 1930s, and it was a really big deal. The author of the book that you may be familiar with, War is a Racket, Smedley Butler, former Marine Corps General Smedley Butler, he was going to be the dictator. They recruited him. They wanted him to basically get all the guys from the veterans of foreign wars. They'd been to Italy and seen how it was done. And they wanted him basically to recruit the bonus army and all the World War I veterans, the veterans of foreign wars groups and so forth, and march on Washington and seize power. They would make Roosevelt the co-president, and he would basically sign all of his authority over to Smedley Butler, the fascist dictator.
Well, Smedley Butler compiled all the evidence and then marched right up Capitol Hill with the evidence under his arm and said to the Congress, "Hey, Congress, guess what? There is going to be a coup d'etat and a fascist dictatorship, and I know because I was supposed to be the fascist dictator." And he threw his papers down on the table and said, "Here, the proof." And the New York Times covered it, and Congress held hearings for, I think, a week or two, at least a few days worth of hearings. But FDR did absolutely nothing about it. Rockefeller and Morgan and other co-conspirators were never called to Congress to testify. Not a single grand jury was impaneled to investigate, as far as my knowledge. But FDR was basically, because of Smedley Butler walking up Capitol Hill, FDR was able to thwart the plot. Although, as the other Scott Horton writes on his blog, No Comment at Harper's Magazine, he didn't prosecute them or do anything about it at all. And it's an incredible story. And as the other Scott Horton on his blog, No Comment, today, and I presume this is in the BBC documentary that he linked to there, in which you can find the link from thestressblog.com as well, Prescott Bush was in on this plot. That's right. The grandfather of the President of the United States was in on this plot to turn America into a fascist dictatorship in 1934. The documentary's playing right now on BBC Radio. Of course, we all know the story about how while Averell Harriman was off being the ambassador to Great Britain, that Prescott Bush was left in charge of Union Banking Company. He was best friends, had gone to Skull and Bones College with Bunny Harriman. Roland, I think, was his real name. They called him Bunny Harriman, who was Averell Harriman's little brother. And he was given the job of overseeing the business of Union Banking Company, as well as given a major role in the day-to-day operations of Brown Brothers Harriman Company, all operating out of 120 Broadway in New York City. And as you know, some of you may know, J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, seized Union Banking Company for financing the Nazis under the Trading with the Enemy Act. And yeah, that's right. And everybody already knows that, right? That the president's grandfather was a Nazi. That, you know, he was in on the rise of the Third Reich, as were pretty much all major financial interests in America back then. Everybody from Morgan to Ford to the Kuhn Loeb Company and everybody else. Of course, Hitler had a portrait of Henry Ford hanging on the wall in his office. Said, "Henry Ford is the only American who truly understands me." But anyway, so there you go. And I'm trying to remember that. I'll tell you this. The single highest quality, absolute best history of what people would consider, you know, the conspiracy theory history of, say, the 20th century, is Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy by Murray Rothbard. And it's really not conspiracy at all. It's a real historian documenting, I mean, it's a conspiracy, but it ain't a theory. It's real scholarship. And the first time I read Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy, I thought, ah, crap, I wish I had read this a long time ago. Think of, I've read a hell of a lot of stuff about a lot of old banking families and wars begun by Council on Foreign Relations members and so forth in my day. But it's all in Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy. And now I'm scratching my head and trying to remember if the plot to seize the White House is referenced in there. I'd be interested to ask Justin Raimondo if he knows what Murray Rothbard's take was on the 1934 attempted coup d'etat in America that the President of the United States' grandfather was in on. It is. It's just like Lou Rockwell said in his article over the weekend. It's the 1930s all over again. The communists versus the fascists. And what's a guy who loves liberty to do when he doesn't want to choose from one of those? Which brings me to Hillary Clinton's imperial hubris. If you go to the front page of thestressblog.com, that's my blog, you will see, I'm paging down here, Hillary Clinton's imperial hubris. There's an article by Steve Chapman in The Guardian. And here's this article in the Seattle Times, thanks to Phil for this. Out of right field, conservatives gush over Clinton. It should be pointed out that the people listed here are not conservatives. They are neoconservatives. And that ain't the same thing. And I don't even like conservative ideology. I'm not a conservative. It's a collectivist, statist, murderous ideology, conservatism is. But neoconservatism is a hell of a lot worse. And the following people listed here are not conservatives. They're not. They're neocons. They're world revolutionaries. They're open imperialists. They have nothing but disdain for the rule of law, for the Constitution, for the reserve powers of the states, of the Congress, for free markets, for even traditional notions of, religion and custom and anything else. They are revolutionaries. They are, as Klaus Rinn says, neo-Jacobins. They're sick. And, you know, conservatism is a sick ideology, but it ain't this bad. But so check this out. Anyway, aside from that inaccuracy in the headline here, this is from Matt Stearns, McClatchy Newspapers, who basically, as far as I can tell, do the best job, formerly known as Knight Ridder, do the best job of the mainstream newspaper organizations in America. But anyway, since when is Hillary Clinton the idol of neo-conservative pundits? After Clinton delivered a foreign policy haymaker to Barack Obama's head during a Democratic debate Tuesday, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, a neoconservative weekly, wrote that she answered the now famous "Would you meet with despots?" question firmly and coolly. Rich Lowry of National Review, a neoconservative weekly, gushed, "She excels. Clinton has run a nearly flawless campaign and has done more than any other Democrat to show she's ready to be president." David Brooks, ugh. God, I just get the worst taste of my tongue when I say the man's name. William Crystal's Smithers, neo-conservative, neo-Jacobin columnist at the New York Times, wrote that Clinton, quote, "seems to offer the perfect combination of experience and change, and is changing perceptions in a way that may persuade voters to give her a second look." Charles Kruthammer, conservative columnist at the neo-conservative. Dude, get it right. Charles Kruthammer's not a conservative. Neocon, fascist, asshole at the Washington Post, Charles Kruthammer, summed up the Clinton-Obama smackdown. "The grizzled veteran showed up the clueless rookie." All this from a crowd that has spent the better part of two decades demonizing Clinton and her husband, former President Clinton. So here you go. I guess there's two explanations. One is they know that they have completely destroyed the Republican Party, these neocons, and they figure the only way to get it back is to have a Hillary Clinton presidency. And that way they can, you know, rally people around the GOP flag again and say, at least we're not Hillary. I guess that's one tactical observation. Of course, there have been Republicans on TV who talk about that openly. It's not like a, you know, I'm really smart and figured it out or anything. But then I guess also it could be said, and it seems to be, if we're to believe that these neocons are actually saying what they mean rather than just what they want us to think they mean, they love her. She's tough. She's a warmonger. She's a bloodthirsty imperialist like them. She's ready to be president. She's tough enough. Charles Kruthammer and Fred Barnes and Rich Lowry racing to promote Hillary Clinton's presidency. Now, if that doesn't tell the American people, and particularly Democrat voters out there, everything they need to know, then I guess I just don't know what to do with you. But I'll tell you this, for you libertarians and conservatives and right-wingers and nationalists and Obama voters, anybody else out there, there's only one Republican who can beat Hillary Clinton. Only one. Ron Paul. Giuliani is the front runner. He cannot beat Hillary Clinton. Romney is in second place. He cannot beat Hillary Clinton either. Never mind McCain. He's a shot down plane, smoking, just waiting, counting the moments before it hits the ground and explodes, not unlike the one that he was flying when he got shot down over North Vietnam. But take Giuliani, well, and take Fred Thompson too. Take Thompson and Giuliani and Romney, the three major front runners now in the Republican primaries. None of them can beat Hillary. Why? Because they all are on the record praising George Bush for his genius and his leadership in getting the American people on board to initiate an aggressive war against Iraq. All of them have praised the Iraq war. None of them will come anywhere near openly criticizing Bush administration policy. McCain, who, again, it's way too late for, has said, well, I would have done it different. I would have, you know, started the draft and we'd have a million troops occupying that land forever if it was me. I disagree with, you know, the assessment of that they've done a good job over there. It was the right war, but it wasn't carried out right. That's John McCain's stand. The rest of them are all pro-war. And I'm here to tell you, we're going to be surging into this time next year, no doubt about it. And the American people right now are already opposed to the war in Iraq by a supermajority. They're opposed to the war in Iraq by a supermajority. And all the Republicans have this Iraq war hanging around their neck like an albatross. Hillary Clinton, yeah, she voted for it. But it doesn't matter. Compared to any of these Republicans, she will be perceived as the less warlike. And the people who are most against war, who are mostly on the left, mostly liberals and such, they'll all vote for her anyway just because she's a Democrat and just because she's a woman, just because she likes to wear pink and they like the idea. They'll vote for her anyway. But in a contest between Giuliani, Thompson, or Romney versus Hillary Clinton, she will be perceived as the less warlike by the American people. And the Republican cannot win on those odds. Cannot. Super majority of the American people are opposed to this war and opposed to this foreign policy in general. There's only one Republican who can beat Hillary Clinton. And that's Ron Paul. And the reason for that is because he's been opposed to the war with Iraq since 1991. And unlike all the Democrats who opposed it in 1991, he has not said, oh gee, yeah, I'm real sorry about that. Turned out it was a really great war and I really wish I'd been for it like everyone else, like John Kerry and the rest of these scum. Bill Clinton, for example. No, Ron Paul is still proud to this day and never stopped being proud that he was opposed to the war back in 91, which he wasn't in Congress then, but still. And in Congress, he's been on the record opposed to the war in Iraq really since before the Iraq Liberation Act. He was giving speeches opposing the no-fly zone bombings and sanctions and all that before the Iraq Liberation Act. But he put up a very eloquent fight, a doomed one, of course, against the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998. And he did everything he could to stop the war in Iraq before it happened. In writing, in speeches, in communicating with his constituents back home, going on Washington Journal, which was basically the only TV show that would have him, Bill Moyers, in 2002, and saying, look, the Iraq is not a threat to us. Iraq is not tied to Al-Qaeda. The aluminum tubes have already been debunked in the Post, man. They're for rockets, not, an advanced nuclear weapons program. This is bull. He said, we've been bombing them in the no-fly zones for 12 years, and they haven't been able to shoot down a single one of our planes. this country is now an imminent threat to America? It's not. And he's done everything he could. Nobody can call out Ron Paul and call him a hypocrite on American foreign policy. He's been right all along. He's been right all along on American foreign policy. And I think he could beat Hillary Clinton if he could get the nomination. The question then is whether the Republican base are so... Well, and at this point, who's left in the Republican base except the illiterates anyway, right? But is the Republican base so illiterate and so narcissistic that they're going to insist and nominate Giuliani, who is doomed to defeat at the hands of Hillary Clinton in the fall of 08? Are they going to give the nomination to someone who they know cannot win? Because they still are too childish to admit how wrong they were in supporting the aggressive war against Iraq? Snap out of it. Do you people really want 8 years of Hillary Clinton in power? I'm serious, man. You think George W. Bush has been a bloodthirsty, warmongering, Constitution, Bill of Rights shredding tyrant? Just wait until Hillary Clinton has absolute power. She dropped the Rodham. Maybe we'll have to replace it with Bonaparte. And Bill! She's going to bring Bill with her! Don't do this. Please, Republicans. Please, conservatives. Nationalists, constitutionalists, right-wingers of all stripes, left-wingers, hippies. Don't let the Republican Party nominate Giuliani or Fred Thompson for the nomination, both of whom are absolutely doomed to lose to Hillary Clinton. Don't let them do it. There's only one Republican who can beat Hillary and end this foreign empire. It's bankrupting this country in every conceivable way that you can apply the word bankruptcy. Don't do it. Only Ron Paul can beat her. All right, so that's all I have to say about that. The subject of the rest of today's show is this very strange brand of Christian Protestant religion in this country, which makes up a major base of the war party, particularly the Bomb Iran Party. And so I'm going to play this interview of Bill Barnwell that I did back in March, I guess. Yeah. End of March of this year, 2007. And if the interview that comes on after this with Max Blumenthal is a little bit redundant, well, forgive me, but... There's going to be some things I get into here with the Christian preacher that I don't think Max Blumenthal will be able to address, and vice versa. So anyway, this here is Bill Barnwell, and then after this will be Max Blumenthal from The Nation. You're listening to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas,
I just said that.
I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. I'm joined on the phone by Bill Barnwell. He's the pastor from Faith Missionary Church up there in Michigan and is a regular contributor to LouRockwell.com. He holds a Master of Ministry degree and a Master of Arts in Theological Studies. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hi, Scott.
It's great to make your acquaintance, and I really got a kick out of your article here about Pastor John Hagee,
mm-hmm.
who of the War Party ministers, I suppose, is the one who's getting the most press nowadays, and I'm really interested in this I don't know how new it is, this millennialist movement, or I'm not sure what you call it, the
mm-hmm.
a certain brand of Southern born-again Christians who believe that their role is to form a voter bloc in the Republican Party to make sure that it stays at war for Israel.
Yeah, what we have right now is the popular
end times theology represented in the Left Behind books and in books by people like Hal Lindsey, such as the Great Late Planet Earth, which was very popular in the 70s, and a lot of books by John Hagee, who I have addressed in a couple recent columns. They subscribe to a particular eschatology, and eschatology is the study of the last things and the end times in Christian belief. And their belief is in something called dispensational premillennialism. And dispensationalism is kind of this arbitrary imposition upon the biblical text, saying that God has dealt with people through different times in history, but primarily that he has two peoples right now. God has two peoples, the Christian church and the Jews, or today the nation of Israel, that he each has separate prophetic programs for each of these two groups of people. And that their view is that the nation of Israel figures very much into the return of Christ and the last things, and they see the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 as perhaps the key sign that we are ever impending, moving towards the rapture and the Great Tribulation and all the rest. The important thing to note is that prior to 1830, this theology was completely unheard of. It is now the dominant eschatology, end times beliefs, in about all of your fundamentalist Baptist churches, probably most of your conservative evangelical churches today that are not from the Reformed branch of Christianity. So it has gained a major foothold, but it's basically the flavor of the last century and a half. It doesn't have historical roots. Premillennialism, the belief in a literal millennium period after the return of Christ, that goes all the way back to the first three centuries of the church, but there was not this emphasis on dispensationalism in terms of a pre-tribulational rapture and, you know, the two peoples of God and trying to foment the events of Armageddon and trying to read all sorts of current events into the Bible. This is something that's relatively new and pretty damaging, I believe.
So as a Protestant minister, you believe in the eventual return of Christ as well, right?
Yes.
Just not that you need to force him to hurry up?
Well, I think it's completely irresponsible. And if you look throughout church history, just about every generation of Christians at some point has felt like, you know, history is all culminating towards them. We've seen different levels of that throughout church history, but it probably never as serious as we have since 1830, really since the 20th century. I mean, you did have towards the year 1000 AD, you had just millennial euphoria, and you had some real escalations of those kinds of beliefs, but it's been pretty bad right now. And again, as far as the whole pre-tribulational rapture thing, when I first became a Christian, that was the only game in town as far as I was concerned. That's what I believe because that's all I was really presented with. And I think that's really at issue with plenty of conservative evangelicals, is that they feel that this is the only biblical option. There's not another one that exists. And if you don't believe in this, well, then you must be a liberal. You must not really believe all the Bible. You must be anti-Semitic. You must hate the troops and all these other assumptions.
Mm-hmm. And yet you say in your articles that this is the worst sort of cut and paste job on the Bible, that no one who reads the actual Bible would come up with this stuff on their own.
I don't think they would if they were just open the Bible and start reading on their own. What you have is a systematic theology which is imposed right on the text. So for a new Christian or somebody who's been a Christian a long time, there's some key texts in various parts of the Bible that have been hacked up by various theologians and mainly popular teachers. Dispensationalism has never been a scholastic movement, first and foremost. It's always been lay-driven, you know, out on the popular level. So you have these books and these charts, and you cut a little bit out of Ezekiel 38 and 39, 1 Thessalonians 4, the book of Revelation, Matthew 24, Mark 13, tie all these things together in a nice, neat system and present it to the masses, and it will somewhat make sense, you know, to people who haven't really read through everything in context. But here's what people don't understand. I get people that write me and insinuate that I'm not really believing in the Bible. What they need to know is it's the Bible itself which convinced me against the dispensational, pre-tribulational view. It's because I have such high respect for the Scriptures and take them as seriously as I do that I no longer believe that. And I think if someone really does look at all the evidence and really does weigh their presuppositions and pre-understandings against the biblical text, I think that they will come out and have their views changed.
Okay, well, what exact sect of Christianity are you a member of?
I am a part of the Missionary Church, and we're a conservative denomination. We have Wesleyan Arminian holiness roots. By that, our theology, we owe a lot to John Wesley, who was a revivalist preacher in England and in America a couple centuries back, and very much into the born-again experience and very much into pursuing holiness. And I think if you looked at even my denomination, probably the dispensational view would be the dominant one. But there's more and more of us who are standing up and saying, wait a minute, this isn't all panning out here. Let's take a look at some other things.
So the Missionary Church is, and please forgive me because I'm completely ignorant about this kind of stuff.
Okay.
But so you're somewhere near the Methodists and the Baptists and the Presbyterians, somewhere around there.
We would have common ground mostly with some of your conservative United Methodists, your Church of the Nazarene, the Wesleyan Church, those kind of denominations that come out of revivalism and Wesleyanism and Arminianism. Presbyterians and groups like that would come out of a more Reformed heritage. And within your Reformed churches, it's very rare to find dispensational premillennialism. They much more are in amillennialism, which they would see that the millennium period is kind of a figurative period of time that we're in now or whatever, or in postmillennialism, seeing that the earth, you know, the world isn't getting worse and worse, but Christians are going to have more and more of a better influence on society, and that things aren't so dark and bleak, and that eventually then Christ would return after a period of time where Christians had a positive impact on the world, not just handing the world over to Satan and, you know, thinking the world is going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, well, and that really is kind of the script here from the Walmart education, I guess, that people are getting out here, the Left Behind and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The European Union takes over the United Nations and creates a new world order, and
yeah.
Satan comes and rules, and then, and correct me when I go off the story, because I really am somewhat ignorant about this kind of thing, but
mm-hmm.
from what I understand, what's supposed to happen here is they're supposed to force Jesus to come back sooner, and Jesus is then going to kill all of the Jews and take all of the true believing Christians up to heaven, and that this alliance with Israel is actually quite cynical.
It's odd, and first let me say that dispensationalism, you know, their prophecy charts and beliefs are always changing with current events. You know, at first it was, you know, the rapture is probably going to come by 1988 because that's 40 years or a biblical generation after the establishment of the, you know, modern state of Israel. Well, that didn't pan out, and a lot of people then had to revise their figures. You know, the Soviet Union was going to be the great evil empire that was going to attack the nation of Israel and, you know, usher in the rapture, or that event would take place after the rapture. And, you know, the common market or credit cards were going to be indications of the mark of the beast. So they're always trying to read current events into the Bible. And that is a very difficult and precarious thing to get involved with because it's so subjective. And almost every single time where people have engaged in this type of, you know, biblical interpretation, they come out to be wrong. And they're constantly having to revise things, yet their followers still follow them. And it's really unbelievable.
I read this thing in The Prospect about Hagee, the liberal journal, where they quoted some grandiose conclusion, and then apparently he cited his evidence for the conclusion last, and the evidence was, it says here in the Bible that Jesus folded up his shawl and left it by the side of the door. And that proves that, you know, he's going to come back on this day and he's going to do this and that, or else why would he have folded up his shawl and left it by the door?
Yeah, that's extremely subjective. And most people who would just, you know, read whatever passage he's referring to would not get that. Most of them don't. So, you know, they accuse their critics of playing fast and loose with the biblical text and being liberal with the biblical text. But yet they're pulling things out, which I don't think the original authors ever intended. And you had asked, you know, previously about Christians' relationship to the Jewish people. Yeah, there's this idea that, you know, they need to support Israel. You know, it's key because God told Abraham, I'll bless those who bless you and I'll curse those who curse you. So then and he was talking to Abraham, the Hebrew singular there, and the Jewish people obviously are descendants from Abraham. So today they carry this over into, well, God is still fulfilling his promise to the Jewish people. And that's why they have this land, and they need all this, these land boundaries that God had promised in the Old Testament and did fulfill. There's verses in the book of Joshua and elsewhere that God fulfilled all his promises of the land that he gave to the Jews. Well, anyway, they say today that this is still binding, and that if you today, as a Christian, don't support basically all the political, military, you know, objectives of the nation of Israel today, modern secular Israel, that you are an anti-Semite, that, you know, you are opposing God, and God will then oppose you. And basically, it's the idea that once the Christians are all raptured and are out of the way, well, then all the forces of darkness are going to come upon the Jews in Israel. And most of them believe that two-thirds of the Jews are going to perish. And what's going to be even worse Holocaust than what we saw in the late 30s and early 40s. So it is very bizarre, and you really don't hear that talked about much in the pulpits, but that's basically what they believe. And they pull that from a verse of Zechariah that plenty of other people believe that this Holocaust, which was talked about, was already fulfilled in 70 A.D. when the Roman forces sieged Jerusalem and murdered untold hundreds of thousands of Jews in that first century. But yet they want to they want another one. They want another Holocaust. And I think is that really supporting the Jewish people? We really have to ask ourselves.
Yeah. Well, and also, they're not just allied with Israel, but with the right wing in Israel. If I remember correctly, in the 1990s, when some of the more liberal forces in Israel were working for giving up the West Bank in order to have peace with the Palestinians, that the evangelical right wing in the United States was opposed and put all their pressure in Congress to try to oppose land for peace in Israel.
Yeah, they won't budge. They don't believe in compromise. They think it's basically their idea is that Israel can do no wrong, the Arabs can do no right. Now, I am hardly an apologist for the Arab nations. I think in many respects, some of the Arab nations that are, you know, conflicting with Israel are very backwards, and I'm an Arab myself. You know, I'm of Syrian descent, and I'm, you know, hardly proud of some of the things that I'm seeing among the Arab states. But yet we have to be sensible. You know, when Israeli soldiers are running over kids throwing rocks at them, at their tanks, we have to say that that's excessive. When Palestinian suicide bombers or other Arab suicide bombers or terrorists are engaging in terrorism, we need to say that that's morally abhorrent. It's wrong. And the evangelicals, the ones that come from the dispensational wing, are very good at calling out the Arabs for their excesses, but they don't want to call out the Israelis because they think that they would be opposing God. And they hearken back to Genesis chapter 12, that if I speak out against what I might think are Israeli excesses, well, then I'm anti-Semitic, I don't love God's chosen people, and God's going to, you know, rain down judgment on me.
Yeah. Well, and again, they're the ones who were trying to set up the Jews for another Holocaust. And this was something that I think Matt Barganier blogged about this on the antiwar.com blog. Here's this guy Hagee at AIPAC, is supposedly, you know, the Israel lobby's closest ally in America, who is trying to set them up to all be killed. And yet if the antiwar.com crowd says, hey, why don't you give up the West Bank and Gaza and try to be friends with your neighbors and coexist in peace? Well, then we're the anti-Semitic crazies.
Mm-hmm. Most Christians don't realize the logical implications of this viewpoint of what's going to happen to the Jewish people after the supposed rapture of the church, of the Christians. You know, a lot of them haven't put two and two together, or it's not really preached so much from the pulpit. But I think the people, and I believe Hagee and those like him, I think they sincerely do believe that they have, you know, that they're doing God's will, and they have the Jewish people's best interest in their hearts. I think it's up for other Christians who maybe haven't made up their mind on this or are a little open-minded to take a look at the biblical evidence and see, does the Bible actually teach this? And secondly, does the dispensational crowd really have the best theology and really have the best interests of the Jewish people going on?
Right. And now, I guess with everything else, we can just leave aside the fact that people's opinion shouldn't necessarily translate into the policy of the United States government, but that's the same way with everything, so I guess we can just leave that aside.
Well, I think it is important to say this, that look, you have some very good and sincere Christians that are dispensational pre-trib people, but you have plenty of them, a lot of them that are not. you know, there's many evangelicals who think just like I do. And, you know, some of our, most of our best biblical scholars from the conservative wing are not dispensationalists. And given the fact that there's so much contention on these issues, and we're dealing with future events which have not transpired, and it's very debatable whether some of them are or are not going to transpire, why would we want to make something that's so contentious, try to translate that into our foreign policy? It makes absolutely no sense.
All right, well, it's because for the people who've already chosen a side, they know they're right and everybody else is wrong, and it's as simple as that. That's why.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, you know, I'm reminded on the Israel question again here, Jim Loeb, an expert on the neoconservatives, man who's been writing about the neoconservatives for 30 years or something, he once told me about a conversation. I forget who was on the other side of it, but on one side was Irving Kristol.
Mm-hmm.
And someone asked Irving Kristol whether it was a good idea for the Israel lobby to buy Jerry Falwell an airplane and spend a bunch of money on him so that he could travel around America preaching his right-wing message that, again, ultimately calls for all the Jews to be destroyed. And his answer was, well, it's their theology, it's our Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from the point of view of someone who's partially Jewish and would very much like to see the people in Israel not all die, that's quite a gamble you're taking when, mm-hmm. when you're talking about, you know, I don't think George Bush really believes in this religion, but this is a group of people in America who have more and more political power, and okay, it's just their theology, but it's their theology that calls for a nuclear war with Russia.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're trying to take very questionable theology, very debatable, that again, your best biblical scholars do not agree with, but yet it's very popular on the popular level, and they're trying to translate that into foreign policy. You know, if we're so unsure of something, we definitely don't want to translate into things that could result in mass casualties and death. That's number one. Number two, I think the position of many folks in the Jewish community is they feel, and very much rightly so, that they are under a lot of irrational anti-Semitism, and they do have a lot of enemies you know, around the world, and they're going to take their support wherever they can get it, even if it's from, you know, a group of people that might be very theologically distinct from them. But as long as, you know, and they don't believe that all these things are going to happen to them in the future, so they figure, well, we might as well accept the evangelicals' financial and emotional, you know, support. But again, you know, giving the logical outcome of what that what those belief structures are, and given, you know, I wonder how many evangelicals, if it was not for this very questionable, debatable theology, really would care about the Jewish people? Would they care about them, you know, even if these supposed mandates weren't there? Hopefully they would love their fellow man no matter what. But right now what we have is that, again, the Jews can do no wrong, but the Arabs are, you know, the big bad guys and must be opposed at all costs.
Yeah.
When you've had so many Christian Arabs who have been driven from the Holy Land in recent decades, and it's almost, it pretty much is, American evangelicals care more about a modern secular Israel than they do about their Christian brethren in these Arab lands. And again, this is no defense and apology, you know, for Arab policies and the prevailing Arab anti-Semitism in the Middle East. I'm not saying that. But there needs to be more balance within the evangelical community on Israeli-Arab relations.
Yeah, well, and I think the simple answer to your question is no, they wouldn't care about Israel at all if it wasn't for this theology, because Israel's a foreign country, and foreigners might as well be cartoon characters to Americans. They're not people at all. And, well, and just as you say, look at the war in Lebanon last summer, where Israel's bombing Christians in Lebanon, and not a peep from Christian communities in the United States about
you
that.
You hardly heard a word, and that was something I had blogged about at the time. And this whole situation was very unfortunate. You had all kinds of, needless death and bloodshed on both sides. But, you know, you had church signs that were putting things out there saying, go Israel. And again, because they thought, you know, people, whenever you have a flare-up in the Middle East, everyone gets real excited and thinks, oh, this could be it. Christ is coming. You know, the end of the world. We're about to get whisked up, and, you know, we're not going to be in this world anymore. And that's like the big focus amongst dispensationalists. It wasn't about, you know, what's happening to Arab Christians. You hardly heard anything. It was very sad. You maybe had a couple little pieces in Christianity Today, but mostly the focus was on how does this relate to Bible prophecy, and you know, we need to support Israel. Yeah. And, you know, I'm hardly a cheerleader for Lebanon and Hezbollah, but, you know, there's a lot of forgotten people who are lost in the shuffle when we have these discussions.
Sure. Yeah, and really, you know, there's no such thing as Lebanon. It's just a border around individuals,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of whom believe this, some of whom believe that. Some of them are guilty of a crime or are members of Hezbollah, and some of whom are not.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I want to go back to a bit of, you know, what this guy Hagee is actually preaching here. Did I get it right when I said that he's predicting or perhaps promoting a nuclear war with Russia?
He believes, based on Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, that Russia is going to form an alliance with certain Islamic nations and that they're going to try to invade Israel and that it's going to result in some kind of nuclear conflagration of some sort. And this event will either take place immediately before or sometime after the rapture or in the Great Tribulation, depending on what prophecy chart you're reading. But yeah, that in Hagee's book, Jerusalem Countdown, he's, you know, very much grasping on these current events. And when he talks about Iran, you know, the Iranian prime minister, he's now the new Hitler. And that's whenever we have a bad guy on the national scene, it, you know, we always got to compare him to Hitler, and it's always going to be, you know, just like World War II. And if we're going to be like Neville Chamberlain, unless we get in and stop it, and it's, you know, it's up to America, you know, to defend the nation of Israel and stop Iranian aggression. And they can say that, but basically their whole theology has it all worked out, that the world's just going to get worse and worse, and there's nothing we can do about all these, you know, nuclear wars and catastrophes that are about to come upon us.
Right. Well, and I think you said in your article that war is good because it shows that we're on the path toward God dropping us our golden rope to get out of here, and world peace is bad because that's the sign of the Antichrist.
Exactly. And again, they get this from one verse, Daniel 9:27. And if I had time, I would explain all these different passages that they use. But if you go into Daniel chapter 9, 24 through 27, we have events that are basically being fulfilled historically. Then in between verses 26 and 27, they have to insert a massive 2,000-plus-year gap. And they futurize this one verse, verse 27. And based on that, they say that this is a picture of the Antichrist who's going to come and make a covenant with the modern nation of Israel and break it after 3.5 years. And then they copy and paste this with a verse from 2 Thessalonians about the man of lawlessness exalting himself now in a rebuilt Jewish temple. So we got to knock down the Al-Aqsa Mosque that's currently standing right now and rebuild the Jewish temple, which that alone would cause a regional, if not world war, and is very theologically, you know, questionable. But yeah, it's we can't do anything for peace. Because they claim that, you know, people will be calling for peace, but they're just false prophets. They're just spirits of the Antichrist. And I had people say it to me, you know, it's not our job as Christians to try to make this world a better place. All we should be about is saving souls, and then Jesus will take care of the rest. And the world is going to progressively deteriorate, and there's nothing we can do about it. And the Antichrist is going to be the man of peace. So when we start talking about peace, that's not Jesus speaking in relation to current events. It's the Antichrist.
Wonderful. So no point in good works, huh?
Apparently not, which is ironic because so many dispensationalists are so caught up in the conservative political movement.
Yeah, trying to force their way on everyone in this society through the law.
Yeah, so why put these efforts in if ultimately they're all going to fail?
Well, maybe they recognize that those are not good works.
I think they haven't realized how bipolar their theology is with their, you know, their practice. Yeah, it really doesn't make much sense. You know, we might as well just all sit back, remove ourselves, and wait for the rapture, which is what plenty are actually doing.
Yeah. Now, how much influence do these people have as a voting bloc inside the Republican Party, inside the U.S. Congress?
Well, definitely. Within church, within your conservative evangelical or with your conservative Catholics, whatever, you know, the majority of them would probably be voting Republican. Mainly because of a couple issues, the abortion issue, the homosexuality issue, and more now, the issue of the military. You know, they see the Democrats as weak on defense. You know, they're not hawkish enough, even though the Democrats are always trying to prove how hawkish they really are and how they can, you know, hang with the Republicans. But unfortunately, the Democrats have chased away a lot of evangelical voters who might otherwise be more receptive to their message, because the Democratic Party is becoming more and more secular and certain sectors of it are becoming more and more hostile to people of faith. So in evangelicals' defense, they feel like they have really no other place to go. A lot of them aren't completely happy with the Republican Party, but they feel like, you know, this is the party that's friendly to us. Bush, he's a Christian. He's one of our guys. We can trust him. You know, when he says he prays and he talked to the Lord about going to war with Iraq, well then, you know, that's something we need to take seriously. So, yeah, most of your conservative Christians are probably voting Republican. I've seen different polls suggest anywhere from 65 to 90%. And the megachurch pastors like Hagee, and what's so dangerous about Hagee is that he does have political connections, and he is very proud of this fact. You know, he has, you know, he claims to have friends in Congress and friends in high places. And it's not like John Hagee himself is going to order an attack on Iran, but him and folks like him have a large sway over, you know, the people in their churches, thousands of people, and in their political activism efforts.
Right, they're very organized.
Very organized. And what concerns me the most is in issues of war and peace, they're so hawkish on issues of foreign policy. And I think a large part of that is because whenever they hear of things going on in the Middle East, again, they think this is prophetic. And we need to be part of God's army, a literal army with tanks, bombs, and guns. And we're going to be Christ's righteous warriors and stand up for justice and so on and so forth. So that's where it becomes very troublesome.
Well, and you know, there's a whole other part of the right that doesn't believe in any of this stuff and yet still is so pro-war. Why do you think that conservatives, the ones who are not believers in this millennialist stuff, are still so ardently pro-war?
Well, Scott, I think one of the key things is because both religiously and politically, they feel that the only, quote, conservative option is to be more hawkish, that somehow if you're less of an interventionist, that you're bordering on liberalism, and that you don't support the troops, and that, you know, you're not part of God's army. So they link these theological and political concepts to think that the only real conservative option is to be more hawkish. So therefore, if you didn't support the war on Iraq for religious reasons, well, then you must be a liberal evangelical or a liberal Catholic. Or, you know, if you use traditional conservative political arguments or libertarian political arguments, well, then you're just a liberal, a wolf in sheep's clothing. And one of the things that conservatives are most afraid of is being called or being considered a liberal.
Yeah, it's just like what happened over at Reason Magazine, I think, and the run-up to the war was because they are the so-called left libertarians. They wanted to prove that they're not liberals, mm-hmm. and so they moved all the way to the neoconservative right when it comes to waging war.
Yep, I always have to preface these discussions, you know, when I'm talking to other Christians and, you know, first prove my conservative credentials that I've been, you know, a reliable ally on, you know, the issues that we care about. But I'm trying to show them that both politically and theologically that, you know, the Christ-like position and a more practical foreign policy position is not one of interventionism, is not one of, you know, the quote, the war party, but is one of restraint and one that is practical and one that's realistic.
Right, one that, and I always refer back to this, it sounds so naive and silly, but when I was a little kid, I imagined that the United States of America would last for another 500 years or something. We'd have this limited constitutional republic and our Bill of Rights, and we'd be at peace, and in the 21st century, we'd all have flying cars, and things would be great.
Well, we're not going to have that bright future if we continue to mortgage off our children and our grandchildren's future with spending ever more money on countless foreign wars and putting ourselves in these dangerous predicaments that are not in our nation's best interest, and I don't believe in our Christians' best interest. And I think it's time that we go back to the words of a wise man by the name of George Washington and follow his foreign policy and what he envisioned for America rather than what some of our more bellicose militant preachers and politicians envision.
Well, you know, Chris Hedges is, he's also, has a master's degree from Divinity School,
mm-hmm.
and I know he considers himself a liberal and not a conservative as you do,
mm-hmm.
But he writes about this same movement and calls them Christo-fascists,
mm-hmm.
and says that it's not just foreign policy, it's an entire make-believe worldview. In fact, I think his latest article for Truthdig is Where Lies Become True, or something like that, about, and he actually begins with a quote from Hannah Arendt about what it means to live in a totalitarian society. The first order of business of the totalitarian rulers is to replace empiricism and observation and argument and debate and, you know, free speech and realism with a narrative that is just beat into your head that has to be true, that there, that no one around here disagrees with, and so neither do you. And by golly, the earth is 6,000 years old, and we have to have a nuclear war with Russia for Israel and the rest of it. And that you're just supposed to buy it as a whole package. And the way Chris Hedges writes it, millions of people do. It's this alternative world where you really couldn't get more honest than, I don't know, Sean Hannity explaining what's happening in the world.
Well, there, I think what concerns me is there's very much a, I wouldn't go, you know, in some circles a bloodlust or this very big focus on control and power within certain sectors of what we call the, you know, the Christian right. And in fairness, I think a lot of these folks think they're doing the right thing and they're otherwise good people and responsible citizens, but their view of how we should formulate public policy a bit troubles me. Now, as a conservative with strong libertarian tendencies, I read the same Bible as them, and I believe that libertarianism and Christianity can be very compatible, or that even you know, traditional conservatism and Christianity can be very compatible. In fact, the neoconservative view of foreign policy, you know, only spans back, you know, the past 50 years. And traditional conservatives were very much non-interventionist. You know, traditional conservatives and our, you know, traditional libertarians of faith do not believe forcing their conscience by brute force on the populace, but by demonstrating the character and spirit of Christ and, you know, trying to love your fellow man as yourself and so on and so forth, that more and more people will, you know, voluntarily want to know more about Jesus Christ and come to the Christian faith. And I find something like that much more productive than what we have today with a lot of Christian rightists wanting to impose their view of the world by, you know, military force or by, you know, legislation here in the United States.
Yeah, well, and see, now I think what Hedges is getting at here too, and again, I don't know how well you think Christianity conforms with Chris Hedges' style of liberalism. I think if we take liberalism, you know, minus all the socialism, but just from a kind of cultural point of view, somebody like Chris Hedges embraces the theory of evolution. He very much believes in Jesus. I know he takes his faith very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But he believes in science. He's in favor of art. He doesn't want the government in your bedroom. He's, you know, a typical, you know, cultural libertarian, so to speak, I guess, in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's talking about is this view, this make-believe view of the world. Well, for example, a view of the world that would allow someone to think that the war in Iraq is, you know, hunky-dory in 2007, which 30% of the American population still does. And,
yeah.
And I guess I wonder what I was trying to get at there was whether you agree with him that parts of this religious view that we're discussing here basically amount to just make-believe. I don't know where to draw the line between John Hagee and, you know, the Branch Davidians.
Well, I think one of the big problems here is that evangelicals on a whole perhaps are not the most critical thinkers, but neither is the general public on a whole. And evangelicals themselves don't know their own Bible that well. There's a large problem of biblical illiteracy, and that perhaps if people truly did understand more of the Bible and its ethical implications, we wouldn't see kind of this frothing of, you know, for war and what have you. Some people say, well, you know, there's no difference between, you know, someone like John Hagee and you know, a quote-unquote moderate a Christian or what have you. I think those charges are unfair, and you can have good Christians that can disagree on some of these more doctrinal or, you know, public policy issues. You know, somebody who is a orthodox Christian, a small O, basically believing in the central tenets of the faith, you know, there are some key issues that unite, you know, biblical Christians together. And some of the things you mentioned I wouldn't necessarily include in that, you know, necessary, you know, to be a, you know, quote, Christian in good standing. But I think really the problem is just a cultural problem, where kind of our public intelligence is becoming has become dumbed down, is now filtered in to our churches, and that's quite unfortunate.
Well, I think the more religious leaders speak out against this American Taliban kind of view of the way things ought to be, particularly conservative religious people like yourself. I know libertarian politically, but culturally conservative people like yourself. The more of you we have speaking out against these American Taliban types, the better, for sure.
Well, we need almost a second reformation when it comes to the issue of eschatology. I think it would be great if more of our churches just said, let's talk about this issue. We know that this is not a black and white thing, despite what the Hagees and Falwells would have us say. Let's think about this. Let's talk about this, at least. Let's have a discussion. I think that would go a long way if we saw a change in this end times theology and some of the implications. I think it would affect the way Christians think and believe and their worldview, mm-hmm. and would help some of them become more productive, responsible citizens and have a bit of a more productive foreign policy. It just really troubles me again that, when it came to the Iraq war, so many Christians were not thinking about really the actual geopolitical arguments. It all had to do with, again, these cartoonish ideas that we're good, the rest of the world is bad almost, and, we have to make everything right, and that also, this has something to do with Bible prophecy. Even though there's no evidence for that, this has something to do with Bible prophecy, and we should all get excited about it. So I'm calling on Christians, themselves, my conservative brethren, to open up the Bible. And I've got, if you go to my blog at www.billbarnwell.blogspot.com, I've written extensively about leaving behind the doctrine of the pre-tribulational rapture and about some of the key verses that dispensationalists use to kind of justify their biblical beliefs. And I've written extensively on lewrockwell.com and many other publications about these issues on foreign policy and cultural living and how, I as a Christian, formulate my decisions and my beliefs. So I think if Christians had these discussions more, it would be very beneficial.
Absolutely. Well, I sure appreciate your time today. Everybody, Bill Barnwell, he's a minister at Faith Missionary Church in, I'm sorry, what town again in Michigan?
I'm in suburban Flint, Michigan.
In suburban Flint, Michigan. That's cool. That's where my cousins are from.
Great.
He is a regular contributor to lewrockwell.com, and you can, again, read his blog at billbarnwell.blogspot.com. Thanks so much for your time today, Bill.
Thank you, Scott.
This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. 92.7 at that rate, actually. We'll be right back.
right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and introducing our guest today, Max Blumenthal from The Nation and maxblumenthal.com. He also writes at the Huffington Post. Welcome to the show, Max.
Yeah, good to be here.
So I was literally astounded and flabbergasted last week when I looked at the anti-war blog and ran the video of your trip to the Christians United for Israel tour, the unauthorized tour, I guess it was, that you took there. Pretty disturbing and yet hilarious at the same time, I must say.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you found some humor in it.
Yeah, well, it's some pretty crazy stuff. In fact, if it's all right with you, I'd like to play a couple of clips here for the good people who haven't yet had a chance to see it. It's, of course, at the Huffington Post, and you can also find it on the blog at antiwar.com. This little clip is your meeting with Tom DeLay.
So we're here with Representative Tom DeLay, the one and only former representative,
yeah.
The Hammer. Can I call you the Hammer?
Sure.
So what brings you to Christians United for Israel?
Well, I was in on the ground floor. I worked with John and Diana Hagee for many, many years on many different projects.
And how much of an inspiration is the Second Coming in your support for Israel?
Obviously, it's what I live for.
Really?
And I hope it comes tomorrow.
Really? Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And obviously, we have to be connected to Israel in order to enjoy the second coming of Christ.
And now that's basically the bottom line here, right, is this certain brand of evangelical Christian who thinks that America's alliance with Israel must be sustained no matter what, and in order to get Jesus to come back and take them all up to heaven in their bodies or something like that. Is that about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the overall scheme of things, but I mean, you have a PR strategy concocted by Christians United for Israel and its founder, Pastor John Hagee, this corrupt megachurch leader in San Antonio, Texas,
mm-hmm.
who which is completely disingenuous and designed to distract from the real agenda. So they say that they simply support Israel because of what it says in Genesis, that, you know, he who blesses Israel will be blessed, he who curses Israel will be cursed, when it's really about Ezekiel, chapters 38 and 39, the battle of Gog and Magog, the battle of Armageddon, which is the battle between the believers, in their minds, anyone who's a born-again Christian, and then the non-believers, or what one guy referred to me as the anti-Christians, which is everybody else. Mm-hmm. Including and especially the Jews. So in the end, the Jews are going to have to be either convert to Christ, which people were very openly told me at this conference, or they're going to die and suffer the eternal torture of damnation, along with every other religion, along with atheists, and along with even mainline Christians who aren't born-again evangelicals. Meanwhile, Pastor Hagee is running around the conference telling reporters, our agenda has nothing to do with end times theology. It has nothing to do with eschatology. And I've got two little PR operatives hounding me the whole time, one of whom is the former assistant communications director for AIPAC, the major Israel lobby group, trying to prevent me from asking members of Christians United about the end times and actually interrupting interviews. So I can't ask about end times because it's so embarrassing for them to have thousands of members of this supposedly pro-Israel organization who openly advocate a second Holocaust of the Jews. So that's what this is about. I consider Christians United for Israel to be an anti-Semitic hate group, which is also Islamophobic and is anti-democratic and dangerous for the situation in the Middle East. And what I was also able to show in my video is how influential this group is. I mean, Joseph Lieberman came and gave them a talk and compared Pastor Hagee to Moses. On a clip, maybe you could play. John McCain spoke at an off-the-record briefing. Roy Blunt, minority leader of the House, came and endorsed Christians United for Israel's agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Santorum was in attendance. The former ambassador of Israel to the U.S., Dory Gold, was in attendance. Last year, Ken Melman spoke there, and Daniel Ayalon, the current ambassador, spoke there. So they're very connected, and they even have connections in the White House.
Ken Melman, that's the head of the Republican Party, right?
Well, that was the former head of the Republican National Committee,
right,
and now he's sort of working behind the scenes from his closet.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say that it's dishonest, that they quote one part of Genesis that says, you know, God wants everybody to be nice to Israel, but what they're really talking about is this other part where Jesus comes back and kills everybody but the true believers and such. There's kind of another layer to that, which you expose in your video, which, you know, to me really brings up the question of whether Minister John Hagee, I don't mean his followers here, but brings up the question to me whether John Hagee believes any of this at all. You talk about his giant Greek mansion and his ranch and his nice cars, and you know, it makes me wonder whether, from his point of view, this whole thing is just completely cynical. It's a good job for him, like you know, Robert Tilton or somebody like that.
Yeah, that's a good question. What, you know, I don't know what he believes, but he's definitely struck a nerve with the evangelical community, and you know, he's condemned by a lot of other evangelical theologians and pastors and just and lay people for his congregation's fetishization of Judaism, which is considered sort of unchristian by a lot of people. I saw dozens of guys walking around at this summit that Hagee convened with yarmulkes on, women wearing tallis. I mean, women don't wear tallis in Judaism. That's the sort of prayer cloth. They were blowing shofars, like, you know, people blow horns at baseball games, dancing to klezmer music. It was a disgusting display to me, you know, as a Jew. And
that's interesting, the fetishization of it. That's a good term for it, because that really, you even show a clip in your video of an American soldier coming up and saluting a guy in full religious rabbi garb and that kind of thing, right?
Well, he was that's a little bit different. They were sort of that plays into Israel's post 9/11 PR strategy, which is you know, cynically claimed that Israel's battle against the Palestinians is the same as the U.S.'s war on terror. So they had an actor in a U.S. Army uniform appear on stage with an Israeli soldier who's on his knees praying with tallis and a yarmulke on, and they both get up and salute each other and then turn to the crowd, and everyone goes wild.
Oh, but that at least was an actor, though, not a real American soldier.
I don't know if they're soldiers or not. If they were soldiers, there, and you know, this is you know, raises questions, because the military has historically you know, embraced separation of church and state. And this kind of display, which is just openly religious, you know, hints at the increasing evangelical undertone in the military. And you know, I actually have received calls from members of the military and former military lawyers asking me, were these actors or were these real soldiers? Because this is really disturbing from a legal perspective. You know, about Hagee, you know, he has these, you know, these constant nights to honor Israel, and they're enormous breadwinners for him. I mean, it's a golden cow for him to have all these people come in who love the fetishization of Jewry, and then he tells them, as I show in my video, to open up their pocketbooks even after they've paid like $250, $300 just to get in the door. And the Israeli right loves it too. He sends a lot of money over there, and that allows him to cultivate influence internationally.
Right. You know, so, if Hagee really cared about these people, he could at least recommend to them that they just donate directly to the IDF. They can at least write that off on their taxes.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hey, let's stop here for a second and play a clip of some of the interviews that you got with people walking around this Christians United for Israel conference. And this was on July 16th. Is that right?
From July 16th to July 18th.
Okay, let's play a couple of clips here.
The denials by Pastor Hagee and his minions of an ulterior end times agenda were directly contradicted by members of their own organization.
Basically, I believe that you have to embrace Israel as part of the second coming.
But when the Battle of Armageddon is over, and they come out of hiding, and they see him, and he tells them who he is. And they say, who is this?
The Jews will accept Christ.
The Jews accept Christ as a nation then, and they are restored.
The Jews are God's chosen people, but they will. I mean, they have to be witnessed to just like anybody else.
Yeah.
There's only one way to heaven, and that says in John 14:6.
What's going to happen to the non-believer? Well, I think it's pretty clear they're not going to be in heaven. So the other place is not too pleasant.
And you're Jewish as well?
Yeah, that's right.
Blumenthal, yeah.
Yeah. And do you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ?
Well, I'm Jewish. So are you going to pray for me afterwards?
Yeah, certainly will. Actually, we've been praying for the whole Jewish race for a long time.
Really? Yes. You've been praying for the whole Jewish race.
We're praying that y'all see the Messiah, because we believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and you guys haven't really come to that recognition yet, but we believe that you do.
That's the Battle of Armageddon. It's the believers against the non-believers. It's Christians against the anti-Christians.
Are you looking forward to Armageddon?
I definitely am.
So you're looking forward to Armageddon?
Looking forward to Armageddon and looking forward to the cleansing of the earth.
Are you guys looking forward to the rapture?
Amen. Amen. Well, I got a bag packed.
Can I get your car when it happens?
You can have everything I own when it happens.
That'll be the last of your worries.
When we disappear, you better start to worry. Because if you haven't seen the Left Behind series, it's scary.
Really?
Yes.
The one with Kirk Cameron, right, from Growing Pains?
I don't even remember. But another reason why we support Israel, we have a common enemy.
Who's
that? Muslim.
The Quran is a false, it's absolutely not the word of God. I was a member of the mainline church, and I'm no different than a Muslim.
So we're fighting what is behind the Muslim people, which is Satan. Because Satan is the one who's actually trying to destroy the Jewish race. Because that way he would destroy God's plan.
And what will happen is, Israel and the Western world, in order to save our type of civilization, have got to fight the Muslim. And if we don't take out Iran, one way or another, if we move out of Iraq, the Muslims are going to take over and they're going to follow us here.
All right. Well, there's a few things to talk about. Now, Max, I got to tell you, I'm not much of a religious guy at all, but I know enough to know that the basic, you know, starting premise of all of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is that there is one God, and God is good, and the devil is nothing compared to God. He could never disrupt God's plan. How could it possibly be that these people entertain the blasphemy that the United States Congress must protect God from the devil? I mean, this is insanity, even according to their own religion.
Yes, it is insanity, and actually, I wasn't able to show it because it wasn't directly relevant, but Tom DeLay had told me that the charges against him for money laundering were cooked up by Satan, and that Satan is behind the left.
Well, if he's talking about my district attorney, Ronnie Earle, he may be right about that, but that's a different story.
Well,
that was a joke, sorry.
I don't know your local politics, but it is blasphemous. It's a political religion. It's very similar to it's a millenarian cult, which is not any different from the cult that planned a subway attack in Tokyo, or Scientology, or any of these other cults that manipulate people through end times theology to get them to do the bidding of their leaders. And these leaders are seeking to cultivate political influence. So they have altered, the text, the traditional Christian text. Not only that, they've extrapolated things that aren't there. The Battle of Armageddon, their extrapolation, their interpretation of it, it just doesn't hold up to the light. It's ridiculous. The idea that Russia is going to lead Arab nations against Israel, along with Ethiopia and 200 million Chinese troops, and then they're all going to be eviscerated in a ball of flames in the air. And where does this come from? Where is this in the Bible? It's absolute ridiculous interpretation by corrupt preachers like Pastor Hagee and Pat Robertson, who interprets these texts on the Christian Broadcasting Network. And there's just no theological basis for it. It's so So it's really what it is a cult, a political cult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a political cult. That's a very good term for it. And the corruption of language revealed in some of the clips that you have there. And again, anybody can go to the HuffingtonPost.com and watch this video. But I don't know if it's one guy or two or three different guys who say the Muslim. You know, this
Muslim,
massive...
Everything is the Jew or the Jewish race.
Right, yeah, everything is singularized.
Yeah.
You know, there is no billion people on Earth who are all individuals with natural rights and their own consciences and their own beliefs. But no, there's the Muslim, and he is backed by Satan, and so we have to stop him. And yeah, again, back to, as you say, this is not just, you know, the Branch Davidians in their own little chapel telling each other this stuff. This is a massive political movement here that has an enormous amount of sway inside the Republican Party, particularly.
Well, yeah, that's pretty insightful. The people I interviewed have a Manichaean worldview, which is not unlike the worldview of our president, and they see things sort of monolithically. So there's the Muslim. Muslims all must think alike, according to these people. And they, the Jewish race is a race. I mean, I don't think they intentionally meant to invoke Nazi language, but it's a way of looking at Jews that sort of outmoded, and it's rooted in anti-Semitism. I mean, the idea that Jews aren't this richly variegated international community that has different beliefs, you know, lays the foundation for anti-Semitic conspiracy thinking and the way they think about themselves. They all think uniformly. They attended this meeting in Washington, this summit, 4,000 people coming together for a common goal. It's sort of anti-democratic, the idea that and it was difficult for me to find anyone who disagreed with, you know, the idea that you have to support Israel as a basis for the second coming. So some people have tried to criticize me, you know, right-wing evangelicals have tried to criticize me and say, yo, well, you only interviewed 20 people out of 4,000 people. Well, there wasn't anyone there who didn't agree with this. And, you know, if there isn't any better evidence than Tom DeLay, I don't know, you know, what else I could have done.
Sure,
I mean, he was one of the founding members of this group.
Yeah, well, and then they threw you out, too. So that's only their own fault if you didn't get a representative sample. It's shown at the end of the movie. And I know you have to go, so I want to ask you really quick. I think what's a pretty fair question, and I guess I already know the answer is it goes both ways here, but who is zooming who? I mean, it would be very easy to see, you know, the Likud party in Israel as... you know, joining forces with this guy Hagee, and all these people are their willing dupes. And so on one hand, it's very cynical that these people ultimately want Jesus to come back and kill all the Jews. They don't really care about the Jews at all, even as they say they support Israel so much. But on the other hand, I'm reminded of the Jim Loeb, actually, who's followed the neoconservatives for, you know, 30-something years, I guess, talked about how Irving Kristol was asked in the early 1980s after he bought Jerry Falwell a giant airplane to go flying around the country in, or arranged for it to be bought for him or something. And someone asked him, is it really a good idea to be joining forces with Jerry Falwell like this? And Irving Kristol answered, well, it's their theology, it's our Israel. And so this really is a kind of cynical exploitation both ways, isn't it?
Right, that's the big question or the big issue. This is a relationship of mutual exploitation. But in the end, while I do see neoconservative, you know, American elements, the Israel lobby, and the and elements of the Israeli government getting the best out of this relationship, because they found a huge base of support in the heartland that they didn't previously have. In the end, it's gonna hurt them and possibly create or compound the existential crisis they face. Because if Israel can't forge a permanent peace with the Palestinians, Israel will cease to exist or have to become officially an apartheid state because of demographic problems that they face. And so basically what they're doing is self-destructive. And, you know, whatever you think about Israel, if you care about Israel, and I personally am no Zionist, but if you care about Israel, you should be concerned about this relationship, because it's just inherently self-destructive and deeply cynical.
Agreed. And I know that you have to go. So let me just thank you very much for your time today. Max Blumenthal, everybody. You can read what he writes at The Nation and at HuffingtonPost.com. His blog is MaxBlumenthal.com. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Let's do it again.
This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And here I'm going to play a couple more clips for you from Max Blumenthal's fun trip to Christians United for Israel. Here's how you can tell that the devil is coming. He wants peace.
The one who forces Israel into a peace treaty with the Arabs is the one who is... You have to watch out for
is the beast.
And also wow. So think about just how backwards that sentiment right there is. How inescapable that logic is. Once you've decided the devil is the one who wants to promote peace between Israel and their neighbors, then how could you ever accept peace? You never could. Profound earthly consequences from this insane religious system. And now here is Max Blumenthal confronting Pastor John Hagee from the, as he accurately describes, extremely corrupt so-called church down in San Antonio about his passage in his book Jerusalem Countdown, in which he implies, I think is a maybe an understatement, he basically comes out and says that it's the Jews' own fault that they've been persecuted all this time.
During the brief session in which Pastor Hagee made himself available to the media, I asked him about passages in his book, Jerusalem Countdown, in which he seemed to blame Jews for their own persecution.
On page 92 of Jerusalem Countdown, you write, "It was the disobedience and rebellion of the Jews, God's chosen people, to their covenantal responsibility to serve the one and only true God, Jehovah, that gave rise to the opposition and persecution that they experienced beginning in Canaan and continuing to this very day. Can you explain your support for Israel and the Jewish people in the context of that quote?"
Yes, that's out of the book of Deuteronomy. Have you ever read it?
Yes, I have. I read the Bible.
Well, it's just as true as when Moses read it as it is right now.
And I just wanted to clarify, if by quoting Deuteronomy or by using this quote, you are holding you are blaming the persecution of the Jewish people on the Jewish people for their rejection of Christ.
I'm not blaming. That is an absolute stretch. I never wrote that in the book.
So
I'm quoting a historical fact.
That's one question.
And you see just, you know, what happens once you start accepting this, really any just bogus reality and insist on clinging to it. What happens here is you end up making extraordinary mistakes of judgment, such as blaming the victim. Who's responsible for the Holocaust? Not the National Socialists. No, the Jews are responsible for getting themselves holocausted for disobeying the Bible, according to Israel's greatest friend in America, John Hagee. Wow. Wow, the Holocaust was the fault of the people being shoved in the ovens, not the people doing the shoving. That's what you learn if you go down to John Hagee's church in San Antonio. That's what happens when you learn your religion from books you buy at Walmart. And then Max Blumenthal confronts him and says, "Look, you said it right here. You quote this passage of the Bible. You're clearly, you know, implying here, right?" And Hagee says, "Oh shit, is there a camera rolling? No, I never meant that." Wowee. Geez, I know if I was an Israeli, I would be really happy to have friends like John Hagee at my back. Seems like a really trustworthy guy. Now here's Hagee endorsing Joe Lieberman's call for the preemptive nuking of Iran.
"Therefore, it is time for America to embrace the words of Senator Joseph Lieberman and consider a military preemptive strike against Iran to prevent a nuclear holocaust in Israel and a nuclear attack on Iran."
Now, this is a guy who wants another Holocaust. This is a guy who openly calls for Jesus to come back and kill all the Jews who
don't buy into his phony brand of pre-tribulational, dispensational, premillennialist Walmart Christianity. This is a guy who openly advocates, as do all of his followers, another Holocaust of the Jews. But what does he tell this conference? He says, in order to prevent another Holocaust of the Jews, we must initiate a Holocaust against the people of Persia. We must be the Holocausters so our friends don't become the Holocaustees, he says. That's why we ought to do like Joe Lieberman wants and have a war with Iran, says John Hagee. And I'm certain, you know, as these words leave my mouth and travel down the little electrical signals of this microphone and into your earballs at the speed of light, right now there are faxes and telegrams and emails and phone calls coming into congressmen's offices and congresswomen's offices there in Washington, D.C., saying we want war with Iran. It's part of our religion. We demand that you do something about Iran. And now where are the anti-forces? In fact, this is something I didn't have time to bring up during the interview, but it's in the news over the weekend here. 34 evangelical leaders wrote a letter to Bush asking him to recognize Palestinians' rights. Yeah, that's Palestinians, plural, as in their people too. Palestinians' rights, and urging him to encourage Israel to give up the West Bank so that the Palestinians can have their own state. There is opposition. It's not nearly as well-financed or organized. There is opposition. If there are any, you know, religious people in the audience, I encourage you to look up these 34 evangelical leaders and this group of Protestant American Christians, evangelicals even, who recognize that Palestinians are human beings and that it's not okay to massacre them all the time and oppress them and shoot their kiddos and run them over with tanks and build 30-foot walls across the middle of their property, separating them from their families and their neighbors and their own land. So there is an opposition. They need your help, so join them. Here's another clip. This is not from Max Blumenthal's piece. This is a clip of our president, George W. Bush. This is the kind of argument that I'm used to confronting when talking about war with Iran. And it's really easy to confront.
Today, Iran remains the world's primary state sponsor of terror, pursuing nuclear weapons while depriving its people of the freedom they seek and deserve. We are working with European allies to make clear to the Iranian regime that it must give up its uranium enrichment program and any plutonium reprocessing and end its support for terror.
So there's George Bush, right? And George Bush is not invoking the Bible and a bunch of craziness. George Bush is invoking Earth and actual things that happen. And he says Iran is the number one sponsor of terror on Earth. And what that means is Iran nominally backs Hezbollah and Hamas, even though Hamas is a Sunni organization in the West Bank and Gaza, primarily in Gaza nowadays. They get some funding and help from Iran. Same goes with Hezbollah. Now, Hamas was created by Israel in the first place to be a religious counter to the PLO, and now they're the democratically elected government. They are the Palestinian Authority. And Hezbollah was created as a local militia response to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and the extended occupation there. And according to countless experts, they're really not terrorists, and they haven't been committing terrorist acts in a long time. They're really much more of kind of a bottom-up socialist government, in a sense. Which is not high praise coming from me, but they're not just a stateless terrorist group that goes around murdering people. They actually provide education and health care and the social safety net among not only Shiites, but predominantly the Shiite Arabs in Lebanon. And, you know, have they committed acts of terrorism in the past? Sure. Or is Hezbollah by definition simply a terrorist group? I don't think that's quite accurate to say that. And by the way, Hamas, Hezbollah, they're Israel's enemies, not ours. See how George Bush says, well, they're the biggest sponsors of terror in the world. He wants you to picture those towers falling down again. Well, Hamas and Hezbollah didn't do that. They weren't responsible for that. Iran certainly wasn't responsible for that. But they just make loud and vague assertions and then let you fill in the gaps the way they hope you fill them in. It's a good thing I'm around to fill in your gaps with actual facts, huh? And then he says they must cease all uranium enrichment. Well, they're signatory, the Iranians, they're signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, same as we are. And it says right in there that they have the unalienable right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. And in fact, our government is mandated by its signature and ratification by the U.S. Senate of that treaty to help them. And in fact, all the experts say, again, they really are running out of oil. They need to sell that oil. They want to run their domestic electric capacity off of uranium, which, guess what, is mined in Iran. They have uranium. They want to use it and sell their oil. It's called opportunity cost. It's the closest a state can get to actually deciding something like a capitalist. We'd be better off shooting little atoms out and whatever and heating rods to steam, to turn the steam turbine or whatever, rather than burning all our oil to the same purpose. It's simply an economic decision. And there are International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors on site at these quote-unquote safeguarded facilities. People say, oh, well, there's such concern because Iran kept so much of their nuclear program secret for so long. Well, they were not required by their signature to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, nor by their safeguards agreements with the International Atomic Energy Agency, to declare those parts of their nuclear program. And as soon as they began introducing uranium into their centrifuges, they declared it just like they were required to do. So they say there's this secret nuclear weapons program in Iran, and it's just not true. And the idea that, what, that they're harvesting plutonium in order to make bombs out of plutonium? Well, that's not right. Dr. Prather has explained in detail to me and on this show in front of all you guys that they would have to shut off their reactors for a year, each reactor, in order to harvest the plutonium out of it. And they're not doing that. All this is safeguarded by the IAEA. The only way Iran could develop a nuclear weapon is if they withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty and kick the IAEA out of the country. And so they're not enriching uranium to weapons grade. They're only barely able to enrich it at all. And they're not harvesting their plutonium and making bombs out of it. And now see, that's how easy it is to debunk what George Bush says. Iran is a state sponsor of terror. Yes, so what? So what if they back the Chechens against the Russians? They don't, I'm just saying. If they did, is that any of our business? No, it's not. It's also not our business if they back Hezbollah and Hamas against Israel. We don't even have a treaty with Israel. I don't advocate one. But Iran's enemies are not America's enemies. In fact, Iran is America's closest ally in Iraq, despite what you see repeated as talking points on TV. Iran is the state that backs the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawa Party, the people that America has installed in power, the Maliki government that we're killing everybody else who opposes. Iran is our greatest ally in Iraq. And in fact, they were doing pretty well helping us in Afghanistan too before we made them stop. So anyway, these are the arguments I want to confront. Now all of a sudden I have to argue with John Hagee, who has so little grasp of details. He regularly accuses the Iranians of being Wahhabists, which is an extreme sect of Sunni Islam. It's the brand of Islam that Osama bin Laden subscribes to, which is the exact opposite of the Shiism of the Ayatollahs and the Mullahs in Iran. Night and day. I have to argue with John Hagee, who says that Iran already has nuclear weapons and they can do whatever. He said, oh yeah, they can launch it on an intercontinental missile. They can, you know, make a suitcase bomb out of it. Yeah, right. Yeah. These are the arguments I have to confront now. No, you're not going to get raptured. Okay? There's going to be a war with Iran, and then you're still going to be here next to the rest of us, having to suffer the consequences. Your little magic golden rope is not going to drop from the clouds for you to climb up. You're going to go through the tribulation too. Your own self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just like Bill Moyers said, and I don't often go around quoting Bill Moyers, but he's a decent guy and a fellow Austinite. Bill Moyers said, my God, in my lifetime, I've seen it happen. The delusional is no longer marginal. People, and this isn't part of the quote, but this is me extrapolating. People who believe the earth is 6,000 years old are now in charge of American foreign policy. Or at least are the major American faction of the population, you know, that supports it. Absolute insanity. The American Taliban. No longer marginal. Now running things. How do you like it? Anti-war radio, Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
There's an army of 200 million marching down the river Euphrates coming toward the Persian Gulf. There's going to be the meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion that is unplanned for on the charts of all of the dictators of the earth. It's not an invasion from the north or the south or the east or the west. It's an invasion from heaven. And he will establish his kingdom, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. I am telling you, that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close. John the Revelator says in Revelation the 19th, and I, John, saw the heavens open, and he that sat upon a white horse was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness doth he judge and make war. And out of his mouth shall go a two-edged sword, with which he shall smite the nations of the earth.
Therefore it is time for America to embrace the words of Senator Joseph Lieberman and consider a military preemptive strike against Iran to prevent a nuclear holocaust in Israel and Europe.